Tax Update for Saturday, June the 16th, 2007. This is Tax Update for Saturday, June the 16th, 2007. This week, delay of game. The IRS postpones the effective date for some penalty provisions of the new law. The Tax Update podcast is intended for tax professionals and is not designed for those not skilled in independent tax research. All readers and listeners are expected to do their own research to confirm items raised in this presentation before relying upon the positions presented. Podcast and the document may be reproduced freely so long as no fee is charged for the use of the document or the audio podcast. Such prohibited use to include using the podcast or document as part of a CP presentation for which a fee is charged. The podcast is sponsored by Limeburg Information Services, located on the web at www.limeburgservices.com. Limeburg Information Services offers email newsletters on tax-related matters, as well as access to a library of useful information to tax practitioners that subscribe to their services. Again, you can visit them on the web at www.limeburgservices.com. We're going to look at a continuation of our last podcast discussion, where we're looking at the new penalties imposed under Section 6694. This week, the IRS issued Notice 2007-54, that affects the implementation of these provisions, delays the effective date of some portions of this provision, and gives us some additional guidance on how the IRS will enforce this provision in the interim until we get to at least the end of this year. The notice in question, as mentioned, is Notice 2007-54. That notice is included in full as part of the materials available for this podcast found at the edzollers.com website and noted in the ezollers.libsyn.com feed. If you go to the summary for this week, you're going to find a link to the materials for this podcast. And this week, the IRS said they're going to grant a temporary reprieve from the implementation of parts of this provision, basically the change in standards for the level at which a disclosure would be required for an income tax return. And the notice gives us some temporary relief in one portion of the provision. Now, note the stay is only temporary. Portions of the new provision are still going to be enacted immediately as well and be enforced immediately. So this is a temporary stay on part. It's not meant to change or eliminate or even, I would suspect, allow Congress time to change this provision. Rather, it allows some time for practitioners to grapple with the difference between the more likely than not and reasonable basis standard before penalties are going to be imposed based upon the higher standard for failure to disclose positions on a tax return. Now, key issues when we go through this, we're going to kind of go through this notice in order so you can kind of study how things happen and maybe some commentary on the various provisions. The scope paragraph at the beginning of the notice outlines the returns to which this notice will apply and breaks them into three categories with three slightly different time frames. The first category includes returns, amended returns, and refund claims due on or before December 31, 2007, determined with regard to any extension of time for filing. Second category, 2007 estimated tax payments due on or before January 15th of 2008. And the third category is 2007 employment and excise tax returns due on or before January 31st, 2008. Now, there are a few issues that arise from this date. Note, in the first category, we're including any returns determined with regard for extension. Now, the sentence doesn't completely make clear whether that would include potential but not requested extensions or just those extensions actually granted. What's the difference? Well, it would be this way. If, in fact, what they mean is that it would include any extension that was possible, corporate returns for corporate year ends ending April 30th of 2006 would have a due date of July 15th, 2007. If extended, that due date would be January 15th of 2008. Therefore, measured by the extended due date, these would be subject to the new provisions, and those, as we note, year ends have essentially already ended. The April 30 year in and the returns would be filed here or be required to be filed here in a very short time period. Now, what seems more likely, though, is the IRS meant, well, if you go for an extension and it kicks you past December 31st, then you have to follow the new rules. That still can lead to an issue about being under the new rules for that April 30th taxpayer, because the April 30th fiscal year taxpayer, let's say that taxpayer files for an extension on July 15th because they just couldn't quite get it filed that day, but they come back in and sign the return and mail it in the next day. Based on that, because it would be determined with regard to an extension, we would have a return that may be filed on July 16th, but would be subject to the new higher standard. Again, is that a practical issue the IRS is likely to enforce? I doubt it. But at least in theory, your extension returns beginning with your April 30 year ends appear to require the new standard to be applied. So take a look at that. Now, claims for refund and amended returns don't really have a due date unless we're looking for when the statute runs out. Presumably, what is meant by this notice is those two types of filings would be judged by when they were filed. So if you file the claim for refund or you file the amended return prior to December 31st, then the old standards are going to, or at least the relief will apply. If you file them after that date, they won't. Now, obviously, since filing normally is in the hands of the client, I would hope the IRS is going to interpret this to mean that so long as a return was provided to the client prior to those dates and at least not provided at 11:59 p.m. on the 31st of December, that if the client just didn't get around to filing it or put it off to the side and stuck it in a drawer someplace and then finally files it next February, that we wouldn't necessarily be held to the new standard if that makes a difference on the return. Presumably, the IRS is going to be somewhat reasonable in this regard, and there's reason to believe so, since it is important to note that these provisions do not appear to have been IRS-requested provisions, rather they are the thought of the United States Congress. The IRS goes on in this notice to explain, well, why should we have a delayed effective date? The law made it clear that these are effective for returns filed on or after May 25th, the effective date, basically the date of the law when the president signed it. The IRS explains there are some issues they need to grapple with before we can have this being applied in general to the law, because there were some significant changes made. Let's review those changes real quickly. We both increased the penalties. Well, that's no big deal. The IRS just assesses you for a bigger check. Okay, that's probably not the issue. But these new standards or this new penalty now not only applies to income tax returns, but applies to all types of returns. As well, these new standards change the level or the performance requirements for accountants or CPAs, attorneys, and all those others who are become return preparers. Let's not forget that return preparers now include all types of tax returns, so individuals who maybe in the past were never considered preparers, let us say an attorney who prepared the estate tax returns but never prepared any income tax returns, that person is now covered by these standards and is subject potentially to the penalty under these new provisions. Now, the IRS notes that they have a number of items that they may need to modify and clarify in additional guidance, whether via regulations or other guidance. That includes, they note, activities that would represent preparing a tax return, the definition of who is a tax return preparer under Section 7701A36, and how the rules would apply to both signing and non-signing preparers of a return. The IRS specifically indicates they're considering potential changes to Regulation 301.7701-15. That regulation has the definition of who is an income tax return preparer, and that definition is somewhat important under these rules. The definition is interesting and potentially expansive in this area. And the issue is that quite often it would appear under these rules that an individual who may not be the signing person, therefore a non-signing individual but who had a significant input on an issue on the return, or an individual who's working for a firm but is not the signing preparer, a structure we quite often see in many firms, including my own, where we have preparers that work under but are not normally the signing preparers on returns, that those individuals who are working under the supervision of the signing preparer are still a preparer and potentially subject to this penalty. That non-signing preparer may not have any direct control over whether a disclosure is made with the return or even whether the taxpayer is given that option. Now, to be fair, that issue, like many others under this rule, existed under the old rule. And the practical reality is that in most cases, the non-signing preparers really not only have no idea, no direct control over what was presented to the client for signing, but may not even be aware that something was removed from the return before it was presented to the client for signing the return. So the non-signing preparer may have included a disclosure on a Form 8275. That disclosure may have been pulled by another individual, such as the signing preparer, prior to presenting it to the client. The IRS is going to have to clarify how this works in those situations. We would presume that the good faith defenses would apply in that case, and a non-signing preparer who had raised the issue and who had attempted to include such a disclosure would probably be let off the hook, and the signing preparer would be the one who would be subject to the penalty. I would presume that in most cases, the IRS will primarily look to signing preparers. I don't expect the IRS is going to decide to go after my staff accountant who may have prepared the return, who may have done some work on preparation on the return, assess them a penalty, and leave me as the signing partner alone. I suspect rather it's much more likely to go the other way. As well, the IRS suggests there are going to have to be changes, as should be clear, to the regulations under 6694 itself, because obviously new standards and new level of care will apply, and the IRS is going to have to define exactly how that works under the new rules. Now, the IRS goes on to quickly review the law changes. The IRS notes the amount of the penalty under both Section 6694A and 6694B was increased by the new law, that both penalties were expanded to cover more types of returns, but that the standard of conduct was changed only with regard to the lesser penalty under 6694A. The IRS makes clear they specifically do not grant any relief for the changes under 6694B conduct in the notice. That's because the IRS in its conclusion says it does not feel the transitional relief should be granted to preparers who exhibit willful or reckless conduct. And that is the type of conduct that's subject to 6694B, and that's true regardless of the type of return prepared. So even though prior to May 25th, a preparer doing an estate tax return was not subject to a 6694 penalty for willful or reckless conduct in the preparation of that return that led to this, you know, these off-the-wall positions, the IRS is going to say that nevertheless, after May 25th, we're still going to hold you to that position. You'll be charged even though you may not have been aware that new rule was in place and going. But the IRS is going to grant some relief with regard to 6694A, primarily in the change of standards area. For income tax returns, amended returns, and claims for refund, the IRS has granted that the standards applicable under the prior version of 6694A and the current regulations under 6694 will be applied for filings covered by this relief. That means the realistic possibility rather than more likely than not standard will be used in determining whether disclosure is required to avoid the penalty. And the not frivolous standard rather than a realistic possibility standard will be used to measure disclosed positions. So that basically, you know, we're going to have a easier way to handle these particular cases. Disclosures will continue to need to comply with Revenue Procedure 2006-48, which requires the use of Form 8275 or 8275R, except for those items granted other disclosure standards under that procedure. But if you disclose with regard to 2006-48 and follow the standards that were in place prior to the effective date of this rule, you will be judged under those standards. Basically, you won't be subject to the penalty. Note, if you are subject to the penalty, you will be subject to the higher penalty, not the lower one. It will be the current law penalty. For all other returns now brought under this standard, the IRS is going to go ahead and use the reasonable basis standard as defined in the current regulations under 6662 for filings covered by this notice. Therefore, we don't have to have a more likely than not position, but we must still have a reasonable basis position. Those other returns that will be under the reasonable basis test will include specifically but not be limited to estate tax returns, gift tax returns, generation skipping transfer tax returns, employment tax returns, and excise tax returns per the explicit wording of the notice. The IRS notes that it'll apply the reasonable basis standard in the regulations under 6662, determined without regard to the disclosure standards in 6662. What does that mean? Well, it means this. If you look at 6662, that is the penalty on the taxpayer for failure to disclose in certain situations. And in that case, a taxpayer gets a disclosure if there is a reasonable basis for a position that did not have substantial authority. What the IRS is saying is we're looking to the definition of reasonable basis, but it does not have to be a disclosed position so long as reasonable basis exists. Now, this is not the same standard used for income tax positions. So essentially be very, very careful of how that particular situation works. As well, the IRS silence would imply that reasonable basis rather than non-frivolous standard would apply for disclosed positions. So therefore, which means the disclosure at this point won't really affect the 6694A penalty in these cases directly. Because a penalty relief provision that would qualify for reasonable basis is one the IRS, which is what you could use for disclosure going forward under this rule, is right now a position that the IRS says doesn't have to be disclosed because you had a reasonable basis for these special types of returns. Therefore, for the moment, the disclosure issue under the 6694 provision is essentially rendered inapplicable for purposes of 6694 penalties on non-income tax returns. But that said, the disclosure or lack thereof may very well impact the IRS's view of whether the taxpayer acted or the tax preparer acted in good faith and had a reasonable belief there was a valid basis. If it appears that the tax preparer was playing the audit lottery, I would be very concerned that the IRS may very well take the position that, well, there probably wasn't a reasonable basis, and you know what? We're going to throw the book at you at this point because we think you did not have the good faith belief that this was a reasonable position, because otherwise, why wouldn't it have been disclosed, or at least the issue discussed with the client for disclosure? By the way, we'll get into the fact you probably should be discussing this with the client anyway. Not only should be, you're basically required to. Now, that gets us into the whole issue of the heat this has generated, and there's been quite a bit of discussion generated on online discussion groups about the 6694 penalties and the changes that have been made. And to a certain extent, we appear to have an overreaction to the changes, not so much because these are not serious standards and they don't apply and there aren't issues involved with these positions, but more because maybe a lot of people didn't seem to be aware of the prior standards that were applying and what they had to do in those cases, and that things have not necessarily changed except for when you have to disclose or when you could be penalized for failing to disclose, not nearly as much as some people may think. Now, Kip Dellinger, who's a regular poster and also rather well-known expert on tax practice issues for CCH, has made a number of comments in the California Society of CPAs discussion forum that notes that the more likely than not standard, if you look at the rules that we discussed last time we did the podcast, that discussed the rules of more likely than not versus reasonable basis, there's not a huge differential than reasonable basis. Reasonable basis is not more likely than not, but it's still, according to the regulations, a very high standard. Therefore, it's very high, but not more likely than not. Well, kind of rough testing, if we're going to try to apply percentages here, is kind of some idea of 40 to 45% probability of prevailing. Therefore, you know, it's a close call. It might go against you, or maybe you think, well, at the end, they'll probably go against me, but it's a real close call. I really could win this. There's a real, real, real chance I could win it. It just doesn't quite tip over 50%. Then we have the reasonable basis. Kip notes that there's a narrow crack there between positions that have reasonable basis but aren't more likely than not. If a position did not have a reasonable basis, under 6662, if the client failed to disclose, they were exposed to a penalty for having failed to disclose. Therefore, under our obligations under Circular 230, and if you're a CPA, your obligations under the Statement of Standards for Tax Services, you were to discuss with the client the issues related to that, since that's a requirement of all those covered by Circular 230, to have discussed with client potential penalties and things the client could do to mitigate against those penalties, which would have included disclosure. So in theory, for what's probably 99% of the items that now would be disclosure by the preparer to avoid the 6694 penalty, you should have been talking with your client about disclosure under 6662. And obviously a client's determination not to disclose under 6662, while it didn't disqualify you from doing the work, would obviously factor into your ideas about how you, the type of clients you're dealing with. And eventually you may have decided that a standard that didn't meet the reasonable basis, then we have the issue about did it meet the realistic possibility and were you already exposed anyway? In reality, it seems likely that in many cases, the position was going to fail all of these tests, and so therefore the failure to disclose by the client also was a problem for you disclosing. It's not as if there's now going to be a huge number of cases that previously nobody had to disclose that now need to be disclosed to protect the preparer, but don't need to be disclosed to protect the client. That simply doesn't seem to be happening. It is still concerning that there is a lower standard for the client, and, by extension, a lower standard on everybody in a self-prepared return. Since if there's no preparer, no paid preparer, the standard is going to go back to the 6662 standard. Whether Congress will later revisit 6662 to bring that standard up to more likely than not remains to be seen. Kip also pointed out that if you're a California practitioner, the state of California has operated under the more likely than not standard for preparers to avoid penalties for the last 3 years. So if you're a California practitioner, as most of those who are on the California board would be, theoretically you've been disclosing positions that were not more likely than not to avoid the penalty, at least to the state of California. And by extension, since much of California law basically piggybacks the federal law, presumably you would have had a position that therefore was more likely than not on the federal basis. And while you might have disclosed on the California return, you're just making the same type of position. And I would say most people would presume that the Franchise Tax Board had examined you on this position, which caused IRS issues that might cause the IRS to be interested in the issue as well down the line. Now, my own experience when looking at many of these discussions and talking with people is that it appears a number of preparers for years have kind of ignored the penalty provisions, presuming they really didn't apply to them. That they weren't doing anything wrong, or they weren't doing anything out of the ordinary, therefore these provisions were always for someone else. And now when they read about the more likely than not standard, they're saying, oh, wait, hold it. Now that would apply to me now, because more likely than not is greater than 50%, and that's not fair because I've never come close to being covered. I would argue that if you look at the rules previously in the rules for disclosing to the client, you probably had a number of positions that were covered in the past anyway. Therefore, you probably have had positions where at the very least you should have been discussing with the client. So the issue about the difference or when you have to discuss something or when there's going to be a disclosure going on the return probably isn't going to change that often. The one issue we do have is a potential for an issue that needs to be disclosed to protect me as a preparer does not need to be disclosed by the client. But from a practical standpoint, those types of positions are going to be rare. And given the amount of wiggle room in the two, I suspect that in most cases where you have made the decision that it was more likely than not, that the more likely than not standard didn't pass, you would also almost by definition, because that's going to come close enough for the client to be held to the lack of reasonable basis standard, that you would have discussed disclosing with the client as a protective measure as well. Therefore, as a practical matter, again, not likely there are many changes in that regard. One thing I do think is important is it's clear that with recent actions that we've seen by the Congress and by the IRS and the changes in Circular 230, there is a perception out there that there is a problem among the preparer community. There seems to be a strong perception that far too many preparers, despite ethical prohibitions on their professional standards, may be taking an audit lottery approach. Therefore, it means we take a position that we don't believe has a realistic chance of being sustained if it was examined, but the IRS will never find it, or it's not likely to be raised, and you know the odds of being audited, as we all know, is fairly low. Therefore, we're just going to take the position and figure there's a 99% chance we'll get away with it just because the IRS won't even be able to get to look at this return. And secondly, even if they do, there's a decent chance that they'll miss it on exam anyway. As well, there's a perception that in that environment, not surprisingly, preparers start playing the I can beat that game and start offering these more and more extreme positions, knowing that it's highly unlikely the return will be examined. Therefore, clients can just choose people based upon who wins the bidding for this lowest tax or highest refund, depending upon which market segment you're aiming for. Therefore, the perception is we need to crack down on this. That was aided by certain developments in recent years. Many conversations I've heard have complained bitterly about, you know, the tax shelters that occurred with the large national accounting firms and how we're paying the price for those. But I would point out that just as much we've seen, in fact, in the recent year, we've seen a lot of activity about frauds that occurred at the low end of the market or the lower end of the scale. As well, most of the issues that have occurred in many of the aggressive S corporation, let's take no salary routines, have occurred at the mid-level CPA firms. Let's say, you know, the local firms or the regional, or the, you know, the local firms than the regional firms. Those have been the one most on the forefront in the S corporation self-employment tax game that's also creating a lot of heat these days. Therefore, the perception in Congress seems to have become that these guys need to be, you know, taken out to the woodshed, and that's what Congress wants IRS to do by passing this provision. The IRS, while arguably not terribly thrilled with the provision, is also probably not terribly thrilled with many preparers, and this would give them a tool to use against preparers who aren't paying attention in this area. As well, realize the definition of who is a preparer includes essentially everybody who has their hand on the return under the current Section 7701 regulations. I would suspect those regulations will stay similar going in the future. Therefore, even if you say, well, I don't sign returns, I'm at the lower level in my accounting firm, I don't sign any returns, therefore I'm safe. Argument is, no, you're not necessarily safe. These provisions do apply, and you need to be aware of the provisions. Now, this, as I said, 6694 has become a matter of interest to me because I'm going to be speaking for the Arizona Society of CPAs on tax practice matters as part of our overall tax practice CPE course on the 27th of July that I'll be holding down at the News Center for the Arizona Society over on Washington. So if you're here in Phoenix area, want to be attending, you can look for that and sign up for that course. I'd look forward to seeing you there. This has been the Tax Update for Saturday, June the 16th, 2007. Tax Update is brought to you by Lineberg Information Services, located on the web at www.lineberg.services. Be sure to visit them there and take a look at the offerings they have for those in tax practice. This has been the Tax Update.